This morning, as I said, we're going to talk about marriages. And specifically, what I want us to consider this morning is if a husband and wife have both made a decision in their lives that they want to pursue a relationship, following a relationship with Jesus, how should that make their marriage different from the marriages of other people who haven't made that decision? In other words, should there be a fundamental difference between a Christian marriage and a marriage made up of two people who aren't Christians? And if so, what should that difference be? Now, we tend to think that the difference ought to be if you know and love Jesus, you should have a happier marriage than the people who don't know and love Jesus. But we can look around and we can see people who don't know and love Jesus who have great marriage. And we can see people who know and love Jesus who are struggling. Just empirically, we'd say that apparently knowing and loving Jesus is not the guarantee of happiness, and not knowing and not loving Jesus is not a guarantee of failure. There are people who know and love Jesus who can't make a marriage work, and there are people who don't know and love Jesus who know how to make a marriage work. So the question is there really a difference? If knowing and loving Jesus changes everything, if it has an impact on everything, shouldn't it have an impact on a marriage? And what should that impact be? What should set it apart from other marriages? We need to begin with this premise, and the premise is that following Jesus is all about life transformation. When a person makes a commitment to follow Jesus, when a person says, I'm going to be a follower of Jesus, but what God says on the other side of that equation is, I'm going to grant you forgiveness for your sin, and I'm going to guarantee you that you will live with me forever in heaven. And in between forgiving your sin and living with me in forever in heaven, I'm going to start changing your life. I'm going to begin the transformation process in your life. And so Christianity, being a follower of Jesus, is about this fundamental life transformation that takes place. Your sins are forgiven, God changes your life, and eventually we live with him in heaven. And so there should be some fundamental shift that happens in a person's life when they come to know and love Jesus, and that ought to be reflected in their marriage. A number of years ago, this was back when I was in college, I went to California for the first time in my life. And I'll explain why. When I was in college, my career path was that I was going to graduate from college and then go to law school. I'd spend 3 years in law school, and then I would get out and be an attorney. The reason I wanted to be an attorney is because I had watched Perry Mason on television. Some of you are not old enough to know who Perry Mason is, but he was a lawyer who argued with people every week and always won. And I thought, I want that job. I want to be able to just argue and win every week. And so I thought, I'll be a lawyer when I grow up. I also thought maybe I could help people if I did that. So I'm in undergraduate school, and I'm thinking about where do I want to go to law school. And I went down to the library, and I started looking for different law schools that I would apply to. I was looking through the big directory of law schools and reading about different ones, and I decided I was going to apply to some that I would probably never make it into. And I did. I applied to the University of Virginia, didn't make it in. I applied to the University of Texas, didn't get in there. I applied to Michigan, University of Michigan, didn't get in there. I said I'll also apply to some that I have a better shot of getting into. So I applied to University of Oklahoma and got accepted there. I applied to the University of Tulsa, got accepted there. And I applied to the University of Missouri in Kansas City and got accepted there. But one of the law schools I considered applying to was Pepperdine Law School in California. Not because they're on the beach at Malibu, okay? In those days, they weren't. They were in Pasadena. I decided to apply to Pepperdine because something in their curriculum said, we believe that God's laws are higher than man's laws. And I thought, well, that would be an interesting law school to go to, somebody that starts with that presupposition. So I said, I need to go out and visit Pepperdine. So spring break of my junior year in college, with a group of friends, we drove to California for the first time I'd ever been to California. Now, let me just finish the law school part of this. I sat down with an admissions counselor at the law school at Pepperdine. I said, now, I was curious about this thing, God's laws are higher than man's laws. The person said, yeah, don't worry about that. Some donor probably made us put that in. And I went, okay, all right, fine, thank you, right? So that Pepperdine scratched off the list. That and the I also saw how much it cost to go to Pepperdine. That's scratching off the list, too. So we're out in California. I'm with my friends, and one of my friends says, I know some people who live in California, and we can stay with them while we're out there. So free lodging, that's good, right? You're in college. You're just going to crash with somebody. We showed up at these people's house. They lived in Pasadena, and I'll never forget walking into their house, and within 5 minutes, it felt to me like these were people I'd known all my life. They were just so welcoming, so gracious, so warm. They were excited to see me like they knew who I was, right? And I reflected back on that, and I thought, what is it about these people that just made me feel that the house just was warm? It reflected. And then I came across this verse in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 that says, but thanks be to God who in Christ always leads us in the triumphal procession and through us spreads the fragrance of the knowledge of him everywhere. And I thought, that's what I was smelling in that house. It was the fragrance of the knowledge of Christ. When I walked in, I could just tell these people had a fundamental love that was different than just the casual relationship that most of us have. This passage says, we are the aroma of Christ to God for those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. We are supposed to smell, as Christians, the aroma of Christ. It should be a pleasing kind of aroma, a fragrance, that is attractive to other people. And I experienced in that house in California, and I thought, this is the kind of house I'd like to come to. These are the kind of people I'd like to get to know. And then I began to think about that in the context of marriage years later, where I thought a Christian marriage ought to have that aroma. It ought to be the kind of thing where when people see it, when people come in contact with you, what they sniff from your marriage is something that's attractive, something that's transcendent. And I started thinking, okay, what should that be? What is it, just that you guys smile at each other? Is it just that you guys have figured out how to resolve conflict, or that marital intimacy works for you? What should that fundamental thing be? And I ultimately came up with the idea there are really two things that should mark a marriage of Christians that won't be true about a marriage of non-Christians. First of all, two Christians who are married should have a fundamentally different purpose for why they're married than the non-Christians have. At the core of why you're married as Christians, there should be a fundamentally different purpose than what's at the core of the non-Christian marriage. And then the second thing is that you should have a fundamentally different kind of love for one another than the kind of love that non-Christians have for one another. So that's the outline that we're going to explore this morning. What does the different purpose look like, and what does the different kind of love look like that should mark a marriage? Let's talk about the different purpose for marriage first. Most of you know that throughout the week I work at Family Life, which is a ministry for marriages and families that's headquartered here in Little Rock. And one of the projects I had a chance to work on over the last few years was a project called The Art of Marriage. It's a video series about marriage. And we thought, as we were putting this together, it would be interesting to go out on the street and just ask people, what's the purpose for marriage? What's it supposed to be all about? Just get input from folks about marriage. And as we were thinking about that, we thought, we shouldn't just ask grown-ups. We ought to ask kids what they think about the purpose for marriage. So I want to show you, I'm going to show you three video clips this morning. This is the first one. It's from The Art of Marriage, and this is what we got back when we talked to kids and grown-ups about God's purpose for marriage. So let's kill the lights and watch this.
Do you want to get married to a girl?
Yes.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Okay, why?
I don't know. Because I want kids.
I think most people get married because love is a really strong feeling, and marriage is a way to, like, show that, I guess. A lot of people think it's good. Some people think it's strange. I'd love to feel it.
Are you crazy?
I hate boys.
If I were married, I would be good.
they usually care about each other and they usually smile at each other and hold hands.
I'd like to feel it about someone who makes me happy, who makes me smile, who knows the right things to say, and even if he messes up, he does it in the right way.
The other person likes them and they like them too.
You'll see one day that they look at each other when my mom's making breakfast and they smile, or they say goodbye when my dad has to go to work, and they just give you this warm feeling when you see them do those little things that make you feel what they're feeling. It makes me feel happy that I'm in a family that loves each other and that my parents love each other, and I'm fortunate, and it makes me feel loved and want to love everyone else.
People get married because they want to spend the rest of their lives with each other.
Marriage nowadays doesn't last a good 2 years.
They say it's for love, but then they divorce like 5 years later.
It's because it's lust and not love.
Some people get married because they think it's going to fix them.
Why would I first get married?
These days,
for money.
It'd have to be a buku bucks. I don't know. What about you, bud?
Probably money would be the influence.
Well, I was married 23 years. It was for love. We was both broke, so it wasn't for money. That's for sure.
It's tradition. It's what our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents have done.
It could be done for the wrong reasons, but in my case, I would say it was for the right reason.
People get married because they love each other.
I fell in love with him.
So that I can live with the love of my life and start a family with him, and to show everyone that I love him and I want to spend forever with him.
I think it's biblically driven also.
A sense of a life partner, you know, companionship for life.
I found my best friend and found a woman that will do pretty much anything for me and stand by me no matter what.
We've been married for 33 years, and we're still married right now. We still love each other. We became best of friends, and we became companions, and we also became partners, and we became one.
Good to hear that. I'm always fascinated when I watch that to see the guy who's in there who says, yeah, she'll do just about anything I ask, you know. That's my criteria is for a wife. But stop and ask yourself the question, when you got married, those of you who are married, when you got married, what was the motivation? I'm here to tell you, I did not have strong, biblical, godly motivations for why I got married. I got married for self-serving reasons, right? I think most of us probably were more motivated by self-serving motivations when we got married than we were by godly motivations. Some of you may have been ahead of me on this scale. But when Marianne and I first got married, I had a strong emotional impulse. I mean, I liked her. She liked me. I liked being with her. When I was with her, she made me feel better about myself. She said things that made me feel good. I wanted that to continue for, you know, a while. And I also wanted to, we won't go with what I wanted, okay? When you ask most people, why did you get married? You get answers like, we were in love. We were in love, that's just what you do. But they don't really have an idea. When they say we were in love, what they were saying was we had these strong feelings and we felt like we needed to act on them. Or they'll say, well, we dated long enough, so it was time to fish or cut bait. Kind of like, well, we don't know what else to do after dating 4 years, so maybe we should get married. Or some people get married because there are economic benefits to getting married. You know, we can live together, we can pool our resources, we can get a bigger apartment if we do that. Some people get married because they can have legitimate sex. Some people get married because they want food and laundry and housekeeping services all rolled up in one bundle, right? Some people get married because they're looking for a cure for loneliness. And by the way, let me just say this. I've heard this said. If there is one thing that is more profoundly lonely than being a single person who is unmarried, and that is being a married person who's lonely. There are a lot of lonely married people, and it's more profoundly lonely than it is to be a single person who is unmarried. Some people get married because the clock is ticking. Some people, and I don't mean that clock, you know what I'm talking about. Some people get married because it'll get their parents off their back. Every time I go home, my mom says, so hi, haven't you met? Some people get married because it'll help them in business. Some people get married because it's an escape from a bad situation. They had a bad family situation, and they think, if I get married, I'll escape from this. Some people get married to try to fix a bad situation, like they're pregnant, and they figure they better get married. There are all kinds of motivations for getting married that have nothing to do with God and his purposes for our life, right? And I'm guessing most of you would say, most of you who are married would say, yeah, there was probably a healthy dose of these motivations in why we got married, and maybe a smaller dose of more godly motivations. Most of us, here's my premise, most of us get married for self-centered instead of God-centered reasons. Most of us get married because we see benefit coming for us, not stopping to ask, would this benefit God or his kingdom? Now, I know that's kind of an abstract thought. How does my marriage benefit God and his kingdom? What are you talking about? Well, what we're talking about is, in marriage, do you now have a capacity, both together and separately, to serve God in a stronger way than you would have if you remained single? That's what ought to be at the core of a Christian marriage, not just how will I feel about this, but will I be able to serve God more effectively if I'm married than if I'm single? And can we more effectively serve God together as a married couple than if we're single? I can tell you that I am a much better follower of Jesus today as a married man than I ever would have been if I'd stayed single all my life. Marriage has had a sanctifying impact on my life that has been a part of what has helped me grow in grace and in Christ. That's a part of how God uses marriage. That's about a part of, if I had stayed single, it would not have gone well for me. And so that's where I'm pulling back and saying a fundamentally different motivation for marriage is a motivation that says, how will this advance God's work in my life and in his kingdom if I get married? The reality is that not only do most people marry for self-centered reasons, but most people continue to keep those self-centered motivations at the center of their marriage even after they're married. If you go to most couples and ask them, what is the source of conflict in your marriage, you won't hear many people say, we just can't agree about how we glorify God together in our marriage. That's our big conflict. We just can't agree about how we can advance the kingdom together. What you will hear is a lot of self-centered, I'm not getting what I want, need, feel. In fact, time for clip number two. We're going to watch a couple at the counselor's office talking about why their marriage is not going well. So watch this.
Sharon, Keith, nice to see you both again. Did you both bring back your first week's homework? Thank you. Great. All right. Okay. I'd like to start out this week by having you both clarify some of your answers here. Is that all right? Okay. Sharon, we'll start with you. You say here that the issue between the two of you really started in the first year of your marriage. Is there a specific event that you remember that caused you to be concerned about your relationship?
It wasn't an event so much as it was me feeling lonely and being surprised by that. And I remember wondering why Keith didn't want to talk about things the way we talked about them back when we were dating.
What do you mean?
Well, when we dated, we would spend 2 or 3 hours in a restaurant or a coffee shop, and we would just talk. That happened a lot. But in the first year of our marriage, I remember thinking, why won't he talk to me anymore? He'd come home from work, I'd ask him how his day was, or try to tell him about my day, and it was like talking to a rock.
I talked.
You grunted.
Rocks grunt?
See? This is so typical right here. This hypersensitivity and the exaggeration and the blame. Why don't you do this? If you could just do this. I'm always the problem. If we could just fix me. Well, you know what? This is who I am. And if we're here to fix me, I don't really think it's worth anyone's time.
Keith, you say here that on a scale of 1 to 10, you would give your marriage a 6. What number do you think Sharon had?
Probably a negative number. Is that allowed?
Sharon, do you remember what number you put?
Yeah, a 3, I think.
Now, let's first talk about your 6. Keith, are you happy with your 6?
Am I happy? No. Do I gripe about it? No. Do I think a 6 warrants seeing a marriage counselor and spending hundreds of dollars for someone to tell me that if I showed more feelings, everything would be just fine?
Well, would it?
Would what?
Would everything be just fine if you shared your feelings a little bit more?
No. No, everything would be just fine if she quit trying to control me and if she quit nagging so much. And if we had sex more than 9 times a year.
Whoa. Now who's exaggerating?
Oh, that is not an exaggeration. I can count the 9 times that we've had sex in the past year.
Yeah, well, having sex with a stranger when I'm exhausted and my body is begging for sleep is not at the top of my list.
Huh. 9 times. 9 times. With someone who just lays there.
So, this is a 6.
Yeah. You know, I've learned to adjust. It is what it is. Same old, same old. That's how it is.
All right. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut to the chase. I'm going to tell you what the problem is with your marriage, and when I'm done, we'll decide if it's worth you guys coming back again next week. Sound fair?
Yeah.
You've only heard the tip of the iceberg.
Sharon, I've been talking to couples for 14 years. Some very common patterns here. I'm going to start with you. You ready?
Yep.
Your problem, the problem with your marriage, is you.
Yeah, figured that.
And the problem is you.
Look, I know I'm not perfect, but...
You didn't hear me. You don't have issues. You are the issue. Both of you. I don't know what you were thinking when you got engaged, but I know what most people were thinking. I'm finally going to be happy. I won't be lonely anymore. I can have sex anytime I want. You think love is this warm feeling you get when someone makes you feel special? Sound familiar? Here's the sad truth. You married pledging to love, honor, and cherish each other. But deep down, you were really thinking, I can't wait for somebody to love, honor, and cherish me. So, it ends up becoming this, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back marriage. You talk to me 20 minutes a night, and I'll have sex with you once a week. You take care of the house, and I'll be nice to the kids. It's not marriage, it's let's make a deal. Started back in the 60s during the game show craze. Had a 14-season run. Do you want a 14-season run? You know, the only way this marriage can survive, the only hope that you have, is if each of you are willing to get to the root of it all. Have the courage to reflect on who you are and who you were created to be.
All right. I'm listening. Where do we go from here?
issue for that couple was themselves, their fundamental selfishness and how that manifests itself in a marriage. The fundamental difference between a Christian marriage and a non-Christian marriage is that you're aware of that and you deal with it. For non-Christians, they think that's how it's supposed to be. For Christians, we should be aware that our purpose is not self-serving, it's God-serving. I asked a number of people one time, if you were going to share a verse on marriage with people who were getting married and you couldn't share from the usual, Ephesians 5, 1 Peter 3, Colossians 3, what verse would you share? And one of them said, I'd share the one that I used when I proposed, which is Psalm 34, 3. Oh, magnify the Lord with me and let us exalt his name together. I never thought of that as a marriage verse. That's a great marriage verse because the purpose of marriage is just that. Magnify the Lord with me and let us exalt his name together. Our purpose is to magnify the Lord. You know the verse that says, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all for what? The glory of God is what that verse says. When you marry, do it for the glory of God. Marriage is not primarily about your happiness. Marriage is primarily about God's glory. And when your marriage is about God's glory and his agenda, what he wants to do in your life and through your life, that's when you have a Christian marriage. So, how do you do that? Paul Tripp said, we were made as people to live upward and outward, but most of us live inward. We were made to live upward and outward. Jesus said it this way, all of the law and the prophets can be summed up in this, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, love your neighbor as yourself. When you do that, you're doing what God made you to do. Upward and outward, not inward. A Christian marriage has as its goal God's joy and pleasure, and how can we serve others in the midst of this, including one another in the midst of this. How does your marriage demonstrate anything about Jesus and his church? How does your marriage give off the aroma of Christ? Well, your marriage should be like the model home in a subdivision. You know what the builder does with the model home, right? He puts in all of the features and gets it professionally decorated so that when people come in, they go, I want a house like this. Now, I'm not saying you have to have everything right, but what I am saying is when people see your marriage, they ought to say, I want a relationship like this, because they understand something is different about it. There are three groups of people who are paying very close attention to your marriage. The first group of people that's paying attention to what you're living your marriage for are your kids. When you have kids, they're watching mom and dad and they're learning about marriage from them. Most of you learned what you learned about marriage from watching your mom and dad. I can tell you when I watched my mom and dad, what I learned is the things I didn't want to do in my marriage. I didn't learn what to do, I just learned what not to do. Well, it's good to know what not to do, but if you don't know what to do, you're in no better spot. Elizabeth Marquardt did a study where she looked at the disruptive effect of divorce on the lives of children, and she found that kids who come from divorced homes experience a greater level of anxiety in life. There are all kinds of scars that come with being kids of divorce. But she also found that it's true that kids who come up from an intact, stable home have all kinds of benefits. There's security, there's stability, there's hope, there's joy, they feel that there's better emotional health, better physical health, better spiritual health. Your kids, how you live in your marriage is stamping something on the soul of your kids. And by the way, it's one of the reasons you ought to be pursuing Christ in your marriage, because if you want your kids to grow up strong, healthy, stable, your marriage is a big part of that. They have to see your love for one another. I read an 18-year-old who wrote to us one time and said this, my parents need to realize before they talk to me about God's love for us, they need to show me God's love for one another. It's futile for them to try to tell me about a God who loves me when they can't get along. She understands that. Second group that's paying attention to your marriage are the younger couples who are watching you. I've told my kids for years, find somebody who's 10 years farther down the road than you, and you'd like your life to look like theirs in 10 years, and then just watch what they do. Follow them as they follow it. That's what younger couples are doing with older couples. You old couples in here, trust me, the younger couples in this church are looking at you and going, do I want a marriage like theirs? And if so, how do I get it? And in fact, that's a part of the biblical design. We talk often about we need to be drinking in and pouring out. This is a part of that. Titus 2 says older women are to teach younger women things about marriage. Titus 2 says older men are to teach younger men things about wisdom and life and marriage. We should be modeling, not just teaching, but modeling what that looks like. Third group that's watching to see you is everybody else in the world. The community is watching Christian marriages to see if there really is anything fundamentally different about it. There's a remarkable witness for Christ that comes with a healthy, intact marriage. We tell people, you know, now folks would say, how long have you been married? Coming up on our 37th wedding anniversary. Some people are like, there are really people who have been married 37 years and who look as young as you all do? It's the immediate thought that comes to mind. Folks are watching it. We got an email from a listener who listens to Family Life Today who said, I'm listening to you on the internet. In Dallas, said, I've been listening to stories of couples who have been given hope through your ministry. Even though I'm not married, you've given me hope too. Said, I've been so terrified of marriage because I just can't see how people can really love each other for the rest of their lives. Single listener. Said, even though I know that when a man and a woman commit to the relationship, to each other and to God, God will bless them with the love for each other, I just hardly ever see it. She said, my parents, married for almost 34 years, finalized their divorce on January 13th. I remember Christmas Day. I was sitting at the kitchen table, eating dinner, reading a draft of my parents' divorce decree. And I didn't care. Now, she's lying there. She cared desperately, but she had to wall it off. Say, I didn't care. It didn't bother me that my parents were getting a divorce. It didn't bother me that a promise made before God was being broken. It bothered her terribly. She said, I'm afraid of ending up the same way. I'm afraid of being willing to walk away from a loveless marriage rather than committing to improving it. And it's led me to a fear of marriage in general. It's not completely gone, but listening to you, there's a smidgen of hope, she said. We wrote back and said, this letter got to us, said this second one this week that stopped us dead in our tracks. The other was from a 13-year-old girl who didn't want her parents to get a divorce, asking for free tickets to come to our weekend to remember. We sent them to her. God will take care of you. Don't lose hope. It's tough being a single today. Dennis said, my favorite quote for singles, for a single woman who wants God's best, is what Martin Lloyd-Jones said. Faith is the refusal to panic. Stand firm. We have the opportunity in our marriage to model what God's love for us looks like in our love for one another. And that's a part of how we bring glory to God in a marriage relationship. Our kids are watching. Younger couples are watching. The world's watching. So our marriage should have a fundamentally different purpose. We want God to look good when people look at our marriage. Second thing is our marriage should have a different kind of love for one another. And I'll be quick here. First of all, it should be a self-sacrificing, self-emptying love, not a self-serving love. You get that? The love we should have for one another should be a self-emptying, self-sacrificing love that says, I will put your needs above my own. Paul writes in Philippians, make my joy complete by being of one mind, having the same love, being in full accord, and having the same mind. And then he says, do nothing. And by the way, the Greek word there, when you translate it, it means nothing. Do nothing from selfishness. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Don't merely look out for your own interest, look out for the interest of others. Apply that one verse in your marriage, you'll cure 95% of the marriage issues you got. Do nothing from selfishness, with humility, count the other person. If the only argument you're having is, no, you're more important than me, no, you're more important than me, that'll fix most of the marriage issues you're dealing with, right? 1 Corinthians 13 talks about the different kind of love. Love is, pardon me, love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. Now let me just stop here because you know this passage from 1 Corinthians 13. So I'm going to read it this way. In our marriage, we are patient and kind. In our marriage, we don't envy or boast. In our marriage, we're not arrogant or rude to one another. In our marriage, we don't insist on our own way. In our marriage, we don't get irritable or resentful. In our marriage, we don't rejoice at wrongdoing. We rejoice with the truth. In our marriage, we bear all things. We believe all things. We hope all things. We endure all things. Our love never fails. Now, how many of you could say, that you were just describing my marriage right there, right? To have a loving marriage is for that to be true about how the two of you get along with one another. It's a different kind of love. Here's what the world says. Remember the guy in the video? It's not love, it's lust. It's a self-serving love. I love you as long as you scratch my back, I scratch your back. It's let's make a deal love. A Christian love is a love that says, even when you are not being pleasant, I will lay down my life for you. I will serve you. I will love you. That's a different kind of love. It's also a forgiving love, not a hard-hearted love. A hard-hearted love is that kind of love that says, I'll only love you when you're acting right. A forgiving love says, I know we're going to mess up with one another, and I'm going to forgive you when that happens. I'm going to give you grace because God's given me grace. I'm going to give you grace. Ephesians 4, it says, be angry, but do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger, and don't give an opportunity to the devil. We often skip past that, don't give an opportunity to the devil. Do you understand that when you foster anger toward one another, what you're really doing is saying, I want the devil to win here. I want to be in league with the devil in our marriage. Nobody would say that consciously, but when you are harboring anger, bitterness, hatred, that's exactly what you're saying. I want the devil to win here, and I want to be on his side of this. Ephesians 4 gives the antidote. It says, be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. So we should have a self-emptying love, not a self-serving love. We should have a forgiving love, not a hard-hearted love. And then we should have a spirit-controlled love, not a flesh-controlled love. Here's what I mean. Paul says, as a prisoner of the Lord, I urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you've been called, with humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. It's a love that says, I'm going to be controlled by the Spirit, and I want God's glory in this, and so I'm going to be humble, gentle, patient, bearing with you, maintaining the unity of the Spirit. We often look at those verses and say, well, that describes what a church should look like. Well, before a church can look this way, a married couple, all the married couples in the church need to be looking this way, living this way. So here it is. We should have a different purpose, and we should have a different kind of love. If I had to sum up the different kind of love we should have in three words, it would be commitment, humility, and selflessness. When the love that characterizes your marriage is humble, selfless, and committed, now you're getting close to the kind of love that God's calling us to. Now, at this point, you want the good news or the bad news? Okay, let me give you the bad news. To have the kind of marriage with the kind of purpose and the kind of love I've just described is beyond your grasp. That's the bad news. You cannot achieve that. You can't get there. It's outside of the grasp for you. It's beyond your power or your ability to have that kind of marriage. You may do better than your neighbors, but you will not succeed at consistently having that kind of marriage. That's the bad news. Here's the good news. The good news is we have a Savior who was crucified, who bore our sin and our shame, and who not only offers forgiveness, but you remember what I said earlier? Transformation. So you can't achieve what I've laid out for you, but you can do better tomorrow at it than you did today. Not because you just button up your bootstraps and say, I'm going to work harder. You can do better at it tomorrow than you did today if you are committed to God's purposes and you're becoming a receiver of God's love so you can be a dispenser of God's love to others. That's how you get better. But here's the presupposition. If you want this to work, this has got to work. If you want this relationship to work, this relationship's got to be working. And if this relationship's not working, I can pretty much guarantee you there's something wrong with this relationship for this relationship not to be working. So when this relationship's not working, where we need to look for the issue is what's going on here. Fix what's broken here, and it'll work its way out here. You follow that? That makes sense? Gary Thomas, in his book Sacred Marriage, said, what if God designed marriage to make us more holy than happy? It's a good question. Because most of us got married looking for happiness. God designed marriage for something bigger, deeper than just your happiness. His holiness, his glory, his purpose. A distinctly Christian marriage will be a marriage that is centered on God's purposes and centered on the gospel. We understand what God's done for us, we receive it, and we live it out with one another. That's the difference. And your neighbors may have less conflict than you have. That's not the sign that their marriage is better than yours. Your marriage is a different kind of marriage when God's purpose is the goal, God's glory is the goal, and the love that God has given to us is what we share with one another. When that kind of love is being manifest, now all of a sudden we've got something that will give off an aroma of Christ to a watching world, and people will come to you and say, how do you guys do that? And then you can tell them about the Jesus who makes that possible. I'm going to wrap this whole thing up by showing you a video that I have watched for probably 20 years. Right after I came to Family Life, I heard the story of Robertson McQuilkin, who was the president of Columbia Bible College. It's now Columbia International University in Columbia, South Carolina. In the late 1980s, Robertson's wife Muriel started to show early signs of Alzheimer's. She would tell a story, and then 10 minutes later, she'd tell the same story. And Robertson would say to her, you just told me that, and she would just laugh. And he thought, this is odd, and she was ultimately diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and it became progressively worse until in the early 1990s, he would go to work, and he would find her having walked 3 miles to work barefoot to find him because she was panicked and didn't know where he was. And so he realized he needed to make a decision about caring for her and putting care for her above everything else in his life. And that meant that he would step down as the president of Columbia International University of Bible College. And he went to the student body and he said, I'm stepping down. And he told them why he was stepping down. And I want you to watch. This is just a 2-minute clip from his resignation speech. Watch this.
I haven't in my life experienced easy decision-making on major decisions. But one of the simplest and clearest decisions I've had to make is this one, because circumstances dictated it. Muriel, now, in the last couple of months, seems to be almost happy when with me, and almost never happy when not with me. In fact, she seems to feel trapped, becomes very fearful, sometimes almost terror. And when she can't get to me, there can be anger. She's in distress. But when I'm with her, she's happy and contented. And so I must be with her at all times. And you see, it's not only that I promised in sickness and in health, till death do us part, and I'm a man of my word. But as I have said, I don't know with this group, but I've said publicly, it's the only fair thing. She sacrificed for me for 40 years to make my life possible. So, if I cared for her for 40 years, I'd still be in debt. However, there's much more. It's not that I have to, it's that I get to. I love her very dearly. And you can tell it's not easy to talk about. She's a delight. It's a great honor to care for such a wonderful person.
From that resignation, Robertson McQuilkin cared for his wife for almost a decade before she died. There were several years where she could not speak to him. But does that give off an aroma? Is that a different aroma than the kind of aroma that the world, the culture gives off? It's an aroma that says, I will glorify God, that's my purpose, and I will do it through a self-emptying, self-sacrificing love for others. That's what makes a Christian marriage different than a non-Christian marriage, and it's empowered because of what Christ has done for us and what he's given us. We're going to come to the table this morning to receive communion. And in doing so, what we're really doing is we're acknowledging that we are powerless to live as God's called us to live apart from his sustaining grace and power in our lives. If you're here with us this morning as a visitor, we're always glad to have visitors with us, that this key point in the worship service, this is a part where we turn to folks and say, this table is a family meal for those who have said, I want Jesus to be the central focus of my life. You've turned your life over to him. You've committed yourself to him. Then you're welcome at this table to receive the sustaining grace of God by reflecting on the gospel. There's nothing magical about the bread or the cup up here. But we're really coming and saying, I need Jesus to live the way God's designed me to live. So we come and we get the bread and the juice to say the gospel is at the center of my life. If you're here and you don't know Christ, you don't have a relationship with him, rather than coming and receiving this morning, I just encourage you to reflect on what we've talked about here today. Reflect on the power and the importance of the gospel and what it means to live a self-emptying life rather than a self-centered life. That's what God wants life to be all about, and that's what we want to pledge ourselves to as followers of Jesus. So I'm going to here's how we do it. We come down the outer aisles here to receive the bread and the juice. We'll go up through the center aisle, take the bread and the cup back to your seat with you, and we'll take communion here together in a minute. If you're here as a visitor and you don't know Christ, just stay put as we go through this, and we'll be dismissed here in just a minute. So you prepare your hearts as I prepare the table.